Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for joining us at this late time. But we will call this meeting to order of the Health and Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. Today's date is February 14th. And first item on our agenda today is Senate File 2740 with Senator Abler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll move Senate File 2740 to be before us. And I think this will explain everything. I'll also move the A1 amendment. And if I could, I'd like to make an oral amendment to delete line 1.5, and I'll incorporate that.
Okay.
We're going to keep working on that section, Mr. Chair.
That's...
So I can explain it, though.
Okay. First, you're moving the A1 amendment, and you're deleting, what was the line?
Line 1.5.
Of the amendment, right?
Of the amendment, yes.
Okay.
Just a, and I can incorporate that, I believe, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So we will we'll do the oral amendment first. And any questions to what Senator Abler just presented there on the A1 amendment, just deleting 1.5? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Okay, Senator Abler, to the A1 amendment as amended.
I think we can... We could actually probably move the amendment now. I was going to get some more information about Section 4, but if we keep it in, then I can just, let's just keep it clean. And so, Mr. Chair,
okay,
let me tell you what the amendment does. Deletes Section 1, which is a temporary nursing licensure, which is going to be taken up in a different format. I think it makes sense to try to do some of that, but not for today. The second element, line 1.3, talks about nurses that have been out of service for a little while, that we could go back 5 years, not just two. And so this just allows them to get a credential. It doesn't require anybody to hire them, but at least they're available in the pool. Section 3 is essentially current law about...
We're not doing the town hall this Friday. It's that Monday's President's Day, and my number of people are maybe taking
credit. Anybody know where that's coming from?
I complete.
Oh. Okay.
Are we good, Mr. Chair?
Okay. Go ahead, Senator Abler.
Okay. Hello, Maria King. Anyway, so Section 3 is apparently current law and is not necessary. We were talking about letting temporary nurses' aides start after 8 hours. Apparently, they can do that now. It's actually a question of funding, which is beyond this bill. Section 3 that we're actually going to keep, Section 4 we're going to keep, talks about a temporary assisted living staff training requirements. And so we're trying to make it a little more flexible, and that's going to be worked on, Mr. Chair. And then the final one has to do with, it's called the Temporary Nursing Facility Voluntary Correction Program. And the point of that is if they would like to, assisted livings or nursing homes or anybody would, I think it's anybody, would like to talk to the Department of Health about concerns they have, they can't use that against them on a survey. And so there was one other technical amendment on page 4, line 8, which is just technical. So. Anyway, Mr. Chair, that's the amendment. I'll stand for questions of the amendment if anybody.
Members, any questions about the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment as amended, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes.
And Mr. Chair, just briefly to the remaining elements of the bill. The point of this is to try to help deal with both some of the workforce challenges and also to some of the real crisis statewide with some of the different facilities that are just going to go underwater from lack of staff and economic strain. And we've had actually a bunch of hearings about this in the other committee, and you've brought it up here a few times over the course of the year in this committee. And so we're trying to find a way just to keep it together so individuals can be safe in their nursing homes, assisted livings, and then other facilities in Minnesota, and they can actually stay open. We're at a grave risk of a lot of that falling apart. And so this, in conjunction with the work we're going to do tomorrow in the Human Services Committee, is a part of our answer to help keep it together. And I hopefully at the end of this, it can be our collaborative process with the House and the governor, and we can reach out and actually really make a difference. So that's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Senator Abler. And we're moving on to testifiers, and I see that you've got a couple testifiers on your list. First up, Mr. Toby Pearson. What? Welcome to our committee, and please identify yourself for the record and continue with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson with Care Providers of Minnesota. Today, here on behalf of Long-Term Care Imperative, I'll be splitting my testimony with Matt Steele, who is doing his part remotely. So I will be here to answer any questions, but Matt will be zooming in, to testify and then zooming back out. I want to thank Senator Abler for bringing forward this legislation that looks at very creative, temporary regulatory solutions in response to what is an ongoing operational crisis. The crisis is still running rampant through long-term care facilities. It seems like every week we read another story in a newspaper from a local community saying how their long-term care is struggling and they need to find new solutions. We applaud Senator Abler for his creativity in trying to find ways to address the workforce crisis in our settings, and that continues unabated. And from there, I will turn it over to Matt Steele, who will describe a couple of the challenges that we face, and then I will return again after Matt is done zooming.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to our committee, Mr. Steele, and please identify yourself for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Matt Steele, and I'm the Director of Government Affairs with Leading Age Minnesota, one of two of the statewide associations representing today the Long-Term Care Imperative. And currently, there are approximately 23,000 open positions within the long-term care space. This is about 20% of our workforce. And now we have had chronic issues with workforce. That's not necessarily new information, but this at the present moment has reached new heights. In the fall, when we surveyed our members, we were losing approximately 1,500 workers per month. And we applaud the efforts the governor has tried with training about 1,000 CNAs in 3 months to help solve and remedy this situation. However, if you do the math, we have lost around 4,500 staff in the 3 months it took him to train about 1,000 new ones. So we are down about a net of 3,500 staff members. And quite simply, with the way things are going, this is just unsustainable. Now, as I mentioned, the governor did call out the National Guard to help us. And at the outset here, we just want to say a heartfelt thank you to those who served. And in many cases, National Guard members were literally lifesavers for the residents they served and the workers who got some respite. So once again, thank you for your service. But this leads me to my second point I want to highlight, which is the challenge of occupancy. Our staff shortage, which I just spoke about, combined with the lives lost during the pandemic, has caused a steep drop in our occupancy. At first, prior to vaccine availability, the occupancy decline was related to the pandemic, on average, dropped to about 65%, down from the average of 85 to 90%. Because of our workforce challenges and the inability to admit new residents, occupancy has not been able to rebound to those pre-pandemic rates. The result of our latest survey showed that 75% of nursing homes are limiting admissions, although not as high, still striking, is that 35% of assisted living sites are limiting admissions as well. This is not because they do not have open beds, it's because they don't have staff to provide the care for the people in those beds. This has resulted in what you've heard about, for example, in hospital backups. But also, some areas have reported there's no place for people from the community to get the care they need. In some cases, entire counties do not have beds, and this is clearly highlighting that access problem that needs to be fixed. Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'm going to pass it back over to my partner, Toby, in the Long-Term Care Imperative to share some more additional details on this subject.
Sounds good. Thank you very much for joining us here today, Matt. And we will go back to Mr. Pearson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. The final challenge that we'd like to talk about is cash flow, and this pertains specifically to the last section in the bill that is before you. Despite what has been perceived as lots of federal money going into nursing homes and long-term care, there continues to be more expenses paid out than funds coming in. This is exacerbated by our decrease in occupancy that does not bounce back as quickly as we had hoped. For 2 years, providers have struggled with decreased occupancy and increased costs. Costs of testing, personal protective equipment, or PPE as we call it, they continue in these settings. For 2 full years, we've been doing testing and full PPE. Workers must still use full PPE and are subject to testing. They've been living it, they continue to live it, we're going to live it for the foreseeable future. Providers have spent reserves, maxed out lines of credit, and taken as what one provider said to me, "I've maxed it out and I never would have taken this financial risk in normal times. We are circling the drain." Considering the implications of both increased costs for basic food, medical supplies, and then add on top the pandemic-related costs for overtime, PPE, and testing, it would not be unusual for facilities to spend tens of thousands of dollars each week on PPE alone, money they wouldn't receive in their rates for nearly 2 years. One facility estimated that they were spending over $300,000 per month in overtime, PPE, and testing costs. They simply don't have the reserves to sustain that. When we asked our members about cash flow, basically they're surviving on a month-to-month basis. About 40% of the nursing homes and assisted living said that if they were to miss one payment from the state, they could not cover the next payroll and other expenses. About another 25 to 30% said that they could make it for 1 month, but then could not cover after that. So that's almost 70% of long-term care, that's at both the nursing homes and assisted livings, that couldn't make it for more than 1 month if the state missed a payment. Decreased occupancy, increased costs have resulted in severe cash flow shortages. As you know, long-term care is heavily reliant on state funding through Medicaid and the interaction with rate equalization on private pay. The state is an essential partner to ensure access to long-term care services. You will likely hear more about the need for permanent funding and systemic change in payment as the session progresses. But for now, as we've reminded you of the challenges, we want to just respond to a couple specific provisions in the bill. First, any actions that can provide us with additional workers is a welcome proposal. While the overall numbers of workers we need is significant, each new employee we can recruit and each exhausted staff member we can retain will move us much closer to our goal. And we must examine options like that in Section 5 that allow us space between what is closure and receivership to make it through this difficult time. We need to see if there's a step in between that providers can take. We remain committed to working with the author and the department to try to find creative solutions to the challenges we face. We acknowledge that some of the ideas need a few adjustments in order to pass federal regulations, but we remain committed to trying. And finally, we'd just like to say thank you to all of you for your ongoing support for professional caregivers. Throughout the past 2 years of this pandemic, you've taken extra steps to try to make them feel better. We need more than feelings. We need to look forward to working with you as we work out and address the workforce crisis to face long-term care so that those feelings turn into actions. Thank you.
Thank you. I will just add a quick little comment. As we talked about, you were talking about cash flow and additional workers. Just when I was home this weekend, reading in the local newspaper about our nursing home and the cash flow. Fortunately, it's a county-owned facility at this point, and they've got they're pouring money into it, but they're losing $140,000 a month, or they're $140,000 a month in the red on current operations. And you know, less than 50% occupancy, and it's not because there isn't a waiting list of people wanting to move in. It's they don't have the workers to hire to be able to allow that to happen. So everything you just are covering, no matter where we go when we go home, we see it happening right around us. Members, any comments, questions that you have for the author or the testifier? Senator Abler.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. And actually, Mr. Monahan pointed out a technical petty matter, which we should probably just fix. It's with an oral amendment. When we retained Section 4, I deleted the title description of that. And so I think it's just as easy as to say what words to add back in. On line 1.3, Mr. Chair, I would move to, after the semicolon, to insert temporarily modifying training. And on line 1.4, to add requirements for direct care staff in certain long-term care settings, which just reinstates that title language. And then Mr. Monahan can send it cleanly to the floor, and it can live its life there, fully titled.
Senator Abler, when you were talking about lines 1.3 and 1.4, you're on the original bill?
Up on the bill, yes.
In the title?
In the title, yeah.
Okay. Mr. Monahan, you've got all of that down, so you'll get this corrected for us. Thank you. Any questions on the oral amendment? Seeing and hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes.
Just final comments, Mr. Chair.
Senator Abler, I do have Senator Wicklund with the question first, and then we'll let you wrap it up.
Sure. But
Senator Wicklund.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have one quick question for the bill author, Senator Abler. I guess, can you tell me more? I've heard a couple times it being said that there's still work going on in Section 4, and then Mr. Pearson said that there was more discussion happening, and I'm just wondering, what is the next step for this bill?
Senator Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Wicklund. The next step for this bill is actually going to the floor. However, tomorrow in the Human Services Committee, this is going to be added on to the Senator Housley's bill, and the number escapes me right now. And I don't think it's going to change much between then and now. The intent of both sections is to be a practical way to get temporary staff on track as soon as they can. The governor, if you recall, with the National Guard, put them to work with 8 hours of training as some kind of a CNA. And the other issue, which we actually discussed this summer, or fall, I guess, was the concern that a lot of this is for nursing homes. Some of them are absolutely closing, and so they're even afraid to ask for help for fear it might not be taken the right way. This says if they ask for help, that to the Department of Health, that information would be kept in a separate little file and could not be used as a reason to get a new survey when you say, hey, we're struggling for staff, we're struggling for something. How is that going to work? The Department of Health expressed at that time that they were very willing to help struggling sites like that. And this is an effort to put that into writing. And so this writing is probably yet imperfect, but it expresses the sense of this desire to find it a way to have a no hurt, no fall way to have true issues brought forward to the Department of Health. And they seem very sincere in wanting this to work. And so I'm going to continue to work with the Imperative and the Department of Health and you, Senator Wicklund, if you like, on that. And the reason we took out Section 3 was it seemed duplicative. And Section 4 may indeed be somewhat duplicative, but we want to at least keep that idea there. I don't want to lose something possibly good. And if it is, then we'll just get rid of it. So that's my answer.
Thank you. Senator Wicklund?
Okay, thank you. Okay, that answers that question. I guess I have a couple of questions about Section 2 and about Section 5. And we didn't hear anything from the Board of Nursing on in terms of Section 2. Do you have information from the Board of Nursing about being able to put in place this kind of process for lapsed nursing licenses? And then what, I guess, what assurance, if someone who has had a lapsed license for, you know, 4 or 5 years, I guess, is there anything done to check, to do any checking about their background or anything in the intermediate time frame? Or is this permit just given out with no additional screening or information gathered by the Board of Nursing? So I don't know if the Board of Nursing is here to comment or if you have feedback from them, Senator Abler, on how they would implement this.
Senator Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if they're here, I would be happy to hear their advice. The bill's been out for just a little while. But the idea is that there's a lot of steps to be able to practice as a nurse in Minnesota. You have to have a degree and a credential and be current and all that. We are in just dire need of nurses. And so this would at least remove the credentialing criteria. And it would still be up to HCMC or whoever else if they wanted to hire such a nurse. There would still be a screening process, which would be more site-based or a nursing home. And so I'm, you know, if we need to put any more protections in here, I'm happy to work with you on that. We're trying to remove barriers in times when you cannot get a nurse. We're paying random nurses $275 an hour and just upsetting the whole balance of nursing pay. And so this, to me, just is an effort toward getting qualified folks who are just currently a little out of practice, not, well, maybe in both ways, but to come and to take on a role, and it would be up to the facility to decide what role they would like to do. Some facilities require a nurse to be on staff to dispense things or to make some, you know, some plans which are not at the highest end of their license. So that's my answer.
Thank you. Senator Wicklund?
Yeah, I mean, I understand the spirit of this bill is to be creative, and I appreciate that we are being creative, but then we also want to be, if we're putting something into place that is to last for a year, I guess I would want to also be cautious on the side of patient safety and making sure that the Board of Nursing feels that permit process would be assuring, you know, patient safety is retained, because I mean there is a reason that we have that nurses have licenses. And then I guess in Section 5, I'm just wondering if there's any way that we could get feedback from the Department of Health on this temporary nursing facility voluntary correction program in terms of how different it is from what they do today, the process they use today that allows for people to request technical assistance. I have a question about, you know, whose judgment is it in terms of, you know, they're not complying with standards, and how does that still protect the care of the residents while someone is making this judgment? So I don't know if the Department of Health could comment on this language. I would appreciate that. Thanks.
Okay, we do have members from the department online. If somebody, okay, I see Ms. Reidrich.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Wicklund and members. Thanks for having us here today. I do think we'll probably want to set up a follow-up conversation with Senator Abler to talk through some of these issues. Hearing the discussion today has been really helpful in just helping us understand what it is that you're trying to accomplish with this language. And I recognize that this issue around technical assistance is something that came up in one of the interim hearings that we had a while ago. I would say that even now, our current practice is if someone reaches out with questions, we do not trigger regulatory action in response to questions that people ask. But I think it would be helpful to talk through what some of the concerns are that we might have, particularly around how this would interact with our federal obligations in our relationship with CMS, and how we would support it if you need people who have expertise in these compliance issues, but you can't use any of the current regulatory staff for that, then presumably that means needing to bring on a new group that would focus just on that. And so I think we'd want to talk through that as well.
Okay, thank you. Senator Wicklund?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I think there are questions then to be answered, and I guess I would just want to make a comment that I am a little bit uncertain about voting a bill out of our committee to the floor when there are open questions, and I'll just say that that will cause me to not be able to support the bill today, but I understand that you're trying to be providing creative solutions, and I know that we are in a situation where we need need to find ways. I just want to see us explore ways that have more to do with you know, funding for the people who work in these settings, because I think that might address some of their concerns in a better way. So thank you.
Thank you. Members, any other questions or comments for the author? Okay, Senator Abler, it's back to you.
Just a few closing comments, and I appreciate, Senator Wicklund, your comments are absolutely well taken. This isn't a conference committee. If it were, we would have much more discussion. This is the beginning of an effort to rescue nursing homes that are utterly collapsing across the state. Some parts are already almost nursing home free, and the care for our frail elderly is just really in peril. And so I appreciate everybody working with this. I can tell you, just Ms. Rydrick and we talked about this, that a number of facilities are never going to ask for help if they're afraid it's going to draw some kind of action that they cannot withstand. And so this is a second iteration that we've had. We had voluntary receivership, which just was a whole wrong series of terms. This is an effort based upon those conversations. And to the committee and the Department of Health, I absolutely want to be working with them to perfect this language, to simply have a no hurt, no foul conversation. Hey, what do you think we can do here? Short of them just calling up and sending in the keys. So, and this bill is designed toward that, as is the efforts that we'll hear about tomorrow, to shore up the industry for now. And absolutely, to echo what the imperative said, these issues go far beyond this bill and even the bill tomorrow. And it's the responsibility of this committee, the Aging Committee, and the Human Services Committee to find a way to create a plan for that. And hopefully we can get that work through by the end of session. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sounds good. Thank you, Senator Abler. Senator Abler, would you like to renew your motion to...
I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate File 2740 as amended be recommended to pass and get sent to the floor.
Good. Thank you. Any question on the motion before us? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator Abler. Okay, members, we've got item number two before us now, which is the review of the governor's supplemental budget. And with us is the our Department of Health. And to start us off will be Commissioner Malcolm.
Good afternoon.
Welcome,
Mr.
welcome, and thank you for adjusting your schedule to our crazy schedule this afternoon. But with that, you can continue with your testimony.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Jan Malcolm, Commissioner of MDH. I know you've already had a busy day. I'm very, very happy to be here today to share this governor's budget proposals with you. But first, I wanted to start by thanking this committee for the great support that you've provided to MDH during the last two very difficult years. And I know the same is true of your support for your local public health agencies and your communities around the state. Your support has helped us to move quickly in many instances to support providers, to stand up testing and vaccination. And I just want you to know we at the department and really are grateful for that, and really all Minnesotans should be aware of how important your support has been. So thank you. I'm pleased to present this supplemental budget to you today. It is certainly a sizable request, both for a supplemental budget and for MDH, but it really does represent an extraordinary opportunity that we have with the budget surplus to respond to issues that really have been both clarified, sharpened, and exacerbated, frankly, during the pandemic. as well as giving us an opportunity to make investments in prevention to avoid future problems. This first slide that you're looking at is a quick overview of the whole package. The governor's recommending 29 individual budget proposals for MDH, totaling $233 million in the current biennium, $731 million in the next biennium. Most of these are general fund proposals, but there are a few recommendations funded with Healthcare Access Fund, dedicated revenues, or fee revenues in the SGSR. I'm going to go pretty quickly here. I believe you all have the slides. We've grouped these proposals into a few categories, four categories plus one sort of standalone, if you will. These categories kind of have a common theme. I'll go quickly with a high level explanation of each one. We do have staff here today to answer any questions you have today. We also have fact sheets for each proposal that we'll make available to the committee. And I know that we will have many more discussions about these proposals in the coming weeks, but I appreciate the time to go over them with you briefly now. If it's okay with you, Mr. Chair, I thought I would perhaps pause for questions after each category of proposals, or I can go through the whole thing and take questions at the end, whatever you prefer.
You know, unless somebody has something urgent, they'll interrupt us, but otherwise you go through it, and then we'll keep our questions until you're done, and then we'll see what we've got.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the first category here is addressing healthcare access and affordability. This is one of the features of the governor's budget, and I'm sure you've heard this from Department of Human Services as well. We have a number of these proposals really come from interagency work groups trying to put together comprehensive approaches and the relationships that these categories have with the governor's One Minnesota plan. This is certainly true for this first category here. The next slide, the first of these proposals is to address growing healthcare costs. And we have certainly been talking about expanding healthcare access a lot during many of these past years, but we haven't talked as much lately about cost and how it is we can have a more sustainable healthcare system, not only from the perspective of the state budget, but also for employer budgets and family budgets as well. So there are four interrelated ideas here that are aimed at getting a clear understanding of what's driving the growth in health costs to inform policy solutions to that, while paying particular attention to our rural healthcare systems, which have had some particular challenges, especially during this pandemic. The first idea here establishes a system of spending targets that would set voluntary goals. This is not a regulatory scheme, but rather a set of targets that create motivation for us as a state and healthcare payers and providers to see how we're doing against what would be a reasonable expectation for spending growth in healthcare. A number of other states are doing this. Second idea is to identify strategies to reduce the cost drivers, specifically in administrative spending, and what is often referred to as low value care, where the evidence is really clear that the care provided is not resulting in greater health gain. The third idea extends prescription drug transparency to more entities in the supply chain for pharmaceuticals to more fully capture the cost drivers of this rapidly increasing segment of healthcare costs. And the fourth idea here explores opportunities to adopt some new kinds of payment systems in rural areas, specifically in order to help stabilize them financially. We know that the business model of hospitals who rely on fee-for-service revenues from higher reimbursing procedures has been very seriously disrupted by the COVID pandemic. And it's really helped us understand that we may not have the optimal financing system to assure the access to core needed services at all times. So the next slide, the next idea here is a healthcare provider directory. This may not sound like a flashy idea, but this could really be very valuable for consumers, providers, state government, and payers. What this would do is to create a single centralized statewide database of all health providers in the state and the health plan networks they're in. This would give consumers, health plans themselves, providers, and state agencies a single place to go to get accurate and up-to-date information about what providers are available through which specific insurance plans. This would be quite a powerful tool for consumers, but it would also create some administrative efficiencies for government programs, for health plans, and provider organizations that interface with these different types of insurance. The next proposal provides the authority and resources for MDH to enforce the Federal No Surprises Act, which has some quite broad consumer protections against most of the medical bills that come as a surprise for someone who thinks that they're getting in-network care or expects something to be covered only to get a very large bill from a provider involved in that episode of care who may not have been in-network, totally unbeknownst to the consumer. So this work around the No Surprises Act will enhance price transparency and will prescribe a dispute resolution process between plans and providers for resolving bills between them and between providers and consumers. And it includes some additional provisions to protect insured as well as uninsured patients from surprise bills. The next part of the, the last proposal in this category is around the healthcare workforce. Certainly an issue that, as the last discussion illustrated, is a significant challenge around the country and certainly here in Minnesota. This proposal advances healthcare access and affordability by paying some close attention to the healthcare workforce, specifically the rural healthcare workforce and also the workforce in other underserved clinical service lines and geographies. Labor shortages in the healthcare sector have been severely exacerbated by the COVID pandemic, as you've been hearing, which has also stressed the already rather fragile clinical training infrastructure. So each of the initiatives in this proposal address issues really along that training and practice continuum of the workforce pipeline to bring more qualified and prepared providers into the field. Major components here, increasing rural training opportunities for a variety of professions, including family medicine physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, dental providers, and mental health providers. It also increases funding for the International Immigrant Medical Training Program, which would allow us to better leverage the professional talent among our immigrant communities by helping providers who have clinical experience, but not experience in Minnesota, to meet the healthcare requirements for practice in our state. So that is the first category. The next category is a list of about 10 prevention proposals. And these really address a wide range of opportunities for prevention across the various program areas within MDH. I'm just grateful for the budget and the governor's support in trying to move further upstream to address some critical issues facing Minnesotans and working to prevent them in the first place, rather than missing that opportunity and then dealing with the consequences of the costly interventions down the road after something preventable has happened. So into this category then, the first couple of strategies on the first slide. The first one is a national suicide prevention hotline. Suicide statistics in our state are truly staggering and heartbreaking. Suicide is the eighth leading cause of death in Minnesota for all age groups, and it's the second leading cause of death among youth ages 10 to 19 and young adults 20 to 34. And last year, 34,000 Minnesotans reached out for help by calling the existing National Suicide Prevention Line. This existing National Suicide Prevention Lifeline has a lengthy 10-digit number, and this is a national initiative now to replace that 10-digit number with a new 3-digit number, 988, that will be easier to remember and dial. And it will also have expanded services to include chats and texts in addition to phone calls, reaching even more people. Every state is expected to implement this new system by July of this year. The 988 number will also direct callers to mental health services and supports in our state, making it a comprehensive system. 95% of calls and texts will be answered by in-state providers, making services more localized. The next initiative also responds to a growing issue and one that has also been definitely exacerbated by the pandemic. Drug overdose deaths tragically increased 33% from 2019 to 2020. And while the data on 2021 is not yet complete, it is pretty clear already that 2021 is going to set another record high for the number of lives lost to drug overdose deaths. And for every one of these preventable deaths, for every fatality, there were 14 non-fatal overdoses treated in the hospital. Again, this is the most recent data we have from 2020. The impacts of the overdose epidemic have affected so many people, certainly those struggling with these issues themselves, their families, their loved ones, their communities, their employers. It's truly a statewide issue. And turning the tide in this epidemic needs a comprehensive approach that touches on many factors. So here we're proposing several strategies to take a more comprehensive approach to address the overdose epidemic. First, we propose to develop some regional multidisciplinary overdose prevention teams made up of public health, public safety, behavioral health, education, healthcare providers, and others working at the community level to take a multifaceted approach to understand these phenomena locally and to work to prevent substance misuse and overdose. A second component here is to enhance housing and supportive services for homeless people who are at risk of overdose. And third, to equip business owners with resources to foster a supportive environment and to encourage the success of those working on recovery. Moving to the next slide, the next proposal specifically targets people who are experiencing homelessness and also struggling with opioid use and HIV. In the decade between 2007 and 2017, there was a 300% increase in injection drug use in Minnesota. And as we just talked about, from 2019 to 2020, there was a 33% increase in fatal drug overdoses. We know that homelessness is a significant barrier for substance abuse treatment and for the medical treatment of the conditions that we're discussing here. People with untreated HIV will have higher viral loads than people who are receiving appropriate medical treatment, which poses a risk not only to their own health, but an increased risk for community transmission. Needle sharing is more common among homeless populations, which makes people more susceptible and vulnerable to acquiring infectious diseases like HIV and hepatitis C. So this request expands syringe services programs that reduce the harm associated with drug use for people experiencing homelessness and housing instability. This investment expands services for syringe exchange, both access to clean syringes and disposal of used syringes, which helps to get dangerous devices off the street without increasing crime. And we'll expand overdose prevention services, HIV and hepatitis testing, and we'll connect people to appropriate medical treatment and referrals to treatment for substance use disorders. This proposal is part of a larger request from the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness for investments related to housing instability and homelessness. The next proposal is sentinel event reviews for police-involved deadly force encounters. When someone dies during an encounter with law enforcement, the impact is devastating on multiple levels, certainly for families, for neighborhoods, for entire communities, and as we've seen, for the entire state. And we know that these tragedies have had a disproportionate impact on Minnesotans of color, especially Black and Indigenous Minnesotans. Approaching this issue as a public health problem allows us to take a holistic look at systems and policies and practice changes that can be made upstream to prevent future deaths before the interaction with law enforcement occurs. Public health professionals have been using sentinel event reviews for quite a long time to identify patterns in some of our toughest topic and to make actionable recommendations for prevention. For instance, we use sentinel reviews for drug overdose, infant mortality, and suicide among veterans, and it's proven to be an extremely useful technique. The next slide, the next two prevention proposals, the first is community health workers. Community health workers are trusted resources in the communities they come from. They share life experiences, culture, and language experience with their clients. This makes clients more likely to seek preventive care rather than visiting the emergency department to manage their chronic health conditions and to change behaviors to better support their health. Community health workers are working at the intersection of clinical care to improve access to that care and also addressing the conditions further upstream, what we often refer to as the social and economic determinants of health, living and working conditions, educational success, and the like, that are so often the root cause of so many poor health outcomes. So this proposal does a few things. It increases the hiring of community health workers in not only traditional settings like medical clinics, but also in more untraditional or new settings like public safety, factories, and schools. It will also enhance training for community health workers to better address current health conditions and the cultural specificity of the communities they serve. And it will help to expand data collection and analysis to better understand the impact of community health workers and to improve that infrastructure for the long term in Minnesota. Next, disability as a health issue. People with disabilities face many barriers to living healthy lives. Nearly two-thirds of all people with a disability have a chronic condition, a much higher proportion than people without a disability. And we know that many people with disabilities are not able to find a healthcare provider that can meet their needs, that literally lack the right kind of equipment or clinical expertise to be able to deal with their disabilities. Or these individuals may not have adequate health insurance. As a result, we do see significant disparities in health status and higher healthcare costs over time for persons with disabilities. Even though we do a lot of work with people with disabilities in all of our program areas, we do not currently at MDH have a dedicated program to support people with disabilities. And this is something we've really learned throughout the COVID pandemic, that we need increasing focus to allow us to better coordinate our services across those programs, as well as to work alongside people with disabilities to collect data needed to identify and address gaps. This is a major problem, a major gap in our understanding, is that we often don't have data that we can disaggregate around disabilities. Help us to distribute and administer grants and support partners and improve some of the health disparity gaps that exist in this population. On the next slide, two proposals dealing with lead. We know that there is no safe level of lead in drinking water, and that infants and children are most vulnerable to the lead's toxic effects on brain development. Lead remediation in schools and childcare settings, the first proposal here, is intended to address a source of lead where infants and children drink a lot of water. School buildings are often older construction dating back before lead-free plumbing was required. And we know that many schools and childcare facilities, frankly, are reluctant to test for lead because they lack the funds to address the lead if results show lead in drinking water. And remediation funds can help to overcome this reluctance. Second, the lead service line inventory is intended to address the lead that is leaching into our drinking water before it gets into the home or school. More than 90% of Minnesota's community water systems serve populations of less than 3,300 people, and they're faced with significant capacity challenges. And certainly following the tragedy in Flint, Michigan, there's been much more recognition of the importance of removing lead pipes connecting water mains to homes so that exposures to lead can be prevented. An accurate inventory to knowing where these lead pipe connections are is the first step in alerting residents, establishing a schedule for replacement, and targeting new federal infrastructure funding to remove lead service lines most efficiently. The mandatory federal requirement to conduct a lead service line inventory presents an opportunity to simultaneously complete asset management plans, allowing systems to better plan for future infrastructure needs. This inventory will leverage over $40 million of federal funds. The next slide. The last two preventions, proposals in the prevention category are on this slide. First, mercury skin lightening grants are intended to address the harmful effects of mercury that can be found in skin lightening creams, which adversely affect some of our communities in Minnesota. This proposal would reinstitute a one-time grant program that we had in 2019. Renewal of this program would allow grantees and the department to educate impacted communities about the dangers of mercury and would allow MDH to track mercury poisoning through a required reporting system. Finally, in this category, the climate resiliency proposal also reestablishes a program. MDH had a climate and health program that was not funded at the federal level in the last go round, so that we can support public health related climate activities across the administration, specifically in the governor's climate action framework, and support activities at the local level with grants to facilitate planning and response actions to the effects of climate change and on health, with a particular emphasis on drinking water, specifically through technical assistance, data analysis, and evaluation. So those 10 proposals were the prevention category. And the next category is supporting families and children, 7 proposals here. And these are really prevention strategies as well, intended to improve the health outcomes of Minnesota families and children and leverage a lot of good work. The first proposal on the next slide is a new grant program called Community Healing. If you'd just advance one more slide, please. And is specifically about COVID-19 recovery to fund new community-identified solutions to address the mental well-being impacts of COVID-19 and help communities begin to recover. This will be a collaboration with community-based organizations, faith-based organizations, and local public health departments, many of the partners who've been helping us to get testing and vaccination resources deeper into the communities that have been disproportionately impacted by COVID. But now the work would focus on recovery, and the key here being community-identified solutions, not a pre-identified set of initiatives from us, but rather solutions coming from the community. The next proposal is about recovery as well, specifically long COVID. We know we need to better understand long COVID. The most conservative estimates are that 10% of all people who have had COVID-19 with any level of severity, including asymptomatic cases, will suffer from long COVID. Most estimates are more in the 30% range of all people who've had COVID-19 having some ongoing effects. And again, even mild cases, including among children, can suffer from long-term symptoms. And for many, this is an incredibly debilitating and unpredictable sequelae to the original infection, disrupting their work life, their school life, their family life, certainly impacting their mental health as well as their physical health and their potential to thrive. And what's really frustrating for these patients is that it's such a mix of presenting conditions. It's not just one thing that is long COVID. It manifests differently in different people, and this is all new to clinicians as well. So it's very challenging to diagnose, and clinicians often don't know how to best help their patients suffering from these symptoms. There will be national research, certainly, on this phenomenon, but we see a really urgent need to begin that work here in Minnesota and to start working on guidance for healthcare providers. This will better support our healthcare system to identify and treat long COVID and support those people suffering from it with resources for survivors and support networks. The next slide, the first proposal on the next slide is Community Solutions, a proposal to expand the Community Solutions Grant Program, which was started in June of 2020. Which is about supporting and promoting healthy development for children from prenatal to grade 3. Strong supportive relationships in the home, school, and community can help meet these goals. These grants go to community-led and community-based organizations who serve children who've been disproportionately impacted by disadvantage, poor outcomes in both the education and health setting. This allows us to focus on working with children from prenatal to third grade to reduce racial disparities in health and development along racial and geographic equity lines. Here again, the power of this grant program is that the solutions come from communities themselves and are not predetermined by us. This recommendation, again, expands an existing program. This would increase the size and the number of grants we could give, and extends the program past its current expiration date of June 2023. The next proposal in the supporting families and children category is a major expansion of our home visiting grants. Family home visiting is a voluntary pregnant women and child caregivers who are most in need of services. It links pregnant women with quality prenatal care, supports parents early in their parenting role, and assures that very young children can develop in safe and healthy environments. Currently, Minnesota is only serving about 10% of eligible families who would benefit from some home visiting services. This expansion proposal would include funding for three tiers of home visiting designed to meet the needs of families in this continuing challenging time. First, there would be some short-term regional pilots to test the idea of universal home visiting for everyone in a region, combined with longer-term evidence-based strategies, expanding those across the state, and also expanding evidence-informed strategies to serve priority populations. The next proposal is to support family planning special projects grantees, family planning clinics that have been deeply impacted by COVID-19 and their patients who have deferred critical care in these times. We know that family planning clinics are really on the front lines of screening and treating sexually transmitted infections, and we know those are on the rise. For instance, we saw a 27% increase in reported gonorrhea cases in 2020. So these funds would increase statewide access to evidence-based, voluntary family planning, counseling and education, contraception services, and sexually transmitted infection screening and treatment for Minnesotans who have difficulty accessing services. On the next slide, the next proposal to support families and children is Healthy Beginnings and Healthy Families. This is another significant interagency collaboration between a number of agencies that support activities that we know have a strong evidence base in addressing significant disparities in early childhood outcomes and increasing the number of children who are school ready. This funding will do a few things. First, it will establish a Minnesota collaborative to prevent infant mortality, which has certainly been a priority for the department and is one of Governor Wells's One Minnesota goals as well. This be a public-private partnership focused on community engagement, exchange of best practices and data, and advocacy. MDH will also provide infant mortality reduction grants to communities, tribes, and local public health to improve infant outcomes, again with a focus on those upstream determinants of health. This funding will also allow us to continue the Help Me Connect program, which is an interagency initiative between the Minnesota Department of Health, Human Services, Education, and the Governor's Children's Cabinet. This is a website landing page to facilitate referral and access to community-based resources which are culturally and ethnically appropriate. The funding will also provide access to voluntary developmental and social-emotional screening to identify children in need of further evaluation, support, and resources for children from birth to kindergarten entrance to help ensure that they are ready for school. Finally, the funding would expand the JAIL model practices learning community to help address the adverse health effects for children with incarcerated parents. Parental incarceration is actually the number one adverse childhood experience for Minnesota's children, affecting 1 in 6 children. It negatively affects children's mental health, increases their risk of substance abuse, and impacts their educational outcomes, due in part to the disruption of parent-child relationship. This program partners with county jails to implement evidence-based strategies, services, and supports for justice-involved families. The final slide in this category is our school health proposal. We know the incredible toll that the COVID-19 pandemic has taken on our young people's health, their physical health, their mental health, and their social, emotional learning and coping skills. There's strong evidence that school-based health centers increase access to care, improve health outcomes, and increase academic achievement for children who participate. This is another collaboration with the Minnesota Department of Education and will provide competitive grants to expand health services, including dental services, to existing or new school-based health clinics statewide to meet the physical, mental, and behavioral health needs of students K through 12. So that was the package on children and families. The next category is about sustaining some of the core public health work that we do generally and in some targeted ways. There are seven initiatives in this category. The first is an investment in the public health workforce. Along with our healthcare colleagues in both acute care and long-term care, as you've heard, who have really borne the brunt of this pandemic, the same is true of our state, local, and tribal health departments, who've been working 24/7 for 2 years now to try to provide services and keep Minnesotans safe. And similar to what we've seen in the healthcare sector, with the extreme stress of this just incredibly long duration intensity, we see the same in public health. Public health staff are leaving, particularly governmental public health agencies, to work elsewhere, often with greater pay, or they're leaving the public health workforce altogether. And just as we're seeing across the economy, public health agencies are competing with other sectors to find qualified staff to fill a very large number of vacancies that we have at the state and local public health levels. But this is especially true, this workforce competition in greater Minnesota. So this proposal would offer a set of tools for attracting and retaining a committed, diverse, and talented public health workforce. First, we would expand our existing loan forgiveness program for healthcare professionals to include individuals working in local, tribal, or state health departments as well. We would provide support for a Public Health AmeriCorps program in Minnesota, which colleagues at the University of Minnesota are working to establish. And we would offer educational stipends for students participating in a field placement in a local, tribal, or state health department. A beginning on workforce challenges in this particular public health sector. The next proposal funds safety improvements in long-term care facilities. We've learned a tremendous amount in these last 2 years about how the physical buildings themselves, the physical structures of long-term care, can either contribute to the spread of infectious diseases or contribute to their control to reduce transmission, especially with a disease as transmissible as COVID-19 has been. 50,000 Minnesotans live in facilities that are licensed by the state. Many of these long-term care facilities were built in the 1960s or earlier and badly need some updates to their physical environments to be able to reduce the spread of infections and improve the daily lives of their residents. This proposal would establish a competitive grant program for these facilities to make physical improvements, which could span from investments in communications technology to address social isolation and other modifications, including heating, ventilation, air conditioning systems, or the physical layout of the space, in addition to technology improvements to increase the safety, quality of care, and well-being of residents and staff. The next three proposals on the next slide relate to several of our programs that are funded by fees and put these programs on sound financial footings. The first of these addresses our assisted living and home care licensure programs, two separate licensure programs. Over 2,000 facilities received an assisted living license last year, which was a fantastic response to the new assisted living licensure law. This exceeded our projections for how many facilities would apply for the new license by almost 20%. And in addition, many providers retained their home care license instead of allowing it to expire or to be replaced by a new assisted living licensure. So in addition to the over 2,000 assisted living facilities, we have over 1,700 home care registrations as well. So the higher number of assisted living licenses and the number of continuing home care licenses requires additional staffing to meet the size of this workload and to enforce all of the health and safety requirements within both of these licensure and registration systems. So this proposal funds the needed administrative resources within existing fee revenues. This does not trigger a fee increase, but an increasing appropriation out of the existing revenues. This funding would allow us to increase our staffing levels to ensure that we can do all the required work and consistently with the timelines established in statute. The next proposal also relates to long-term care facilities and hospitals as well. specifically in the area of engineering plan reviews. What this proposal does is right-size the engineering review fee by increasing it to better reflect the demand and complexity of facility expansion and modernization of hospitals and nursing homes, and to ensure that the fees recover the costs. These fees do work on a sliding scale depending on the size and complexity of the project. And currently the plan review fees in the lowest tiers don't cover even the staff time to read the technical documents submitted to prepare for the technical review. Finally, the last item on this slide is a fee and appropriation adjustment to the state trauma system. This proposal does increase hospital license fees and aligns appropriations from the general fund and the state government special revenue fund, SGSR, for use in designating trauma hospitals and ensuring that we maintain an effective statewide trauma system. This proposal allows the department to continue to designate trauma hospitals following industry standards and to ensure that a coordinated healthcare infrastructure system is able to support Minnesota's communities by providing 24/7 emergency trauma and disaster care locally, regionally, and statewide. Our trauma system is a point of pride for us in Minnesota. It began in 2005, but these fees have not been increased for 16 years. We originally thought that some hospitals would seek trauma designation. However, almost all hospitals in the state participate in the program at one or another level of trauma certification. We have 126 hospitals that are designated level 1, 2, 3, or 4 for trauma across all regions of our state. Again, a really strong point for our healthcare system in Minnesota. The last two proposals are the Medical Education and Research Cost Fund Administration. This proposal is a small amount of money, minor adjustments, $150,000 from the existing general fund appropriation for these medical education and research cost, or MERC, grants to support management of the program. Would allow us to maintain and make updates to the online application portal and increase staffing time available to analyze costs across sectors and professions, which would also help us to better target resources to clinical training in underserved and rural areas. The second proposal on this slide, the last one in this category, reinstates the Drinking Water and Wastewater Advisory Council. This does not have a fiscal impact in this bill. But best practice for states is to have an annual review by an external entity of the state's operator certification program for drinking water. So this proposal would reinstate that council and provide a way to identify and address stakeholder concerns in water supply system and wastewater treatment facilities, operator training, and certification. So then we have one final proposal in a category of its own on the final slide here. And as you may know, the governor's supplemental budget recommends, along with his policy proposal to legalize adult use cannabis, the budget recommends establishing a new cannabis management office. This would be separate for MDH, not part of MDH. This cannabis management office would be responsible for the implementation of the regulatory framework for adult use cannabis. As well, the current MDH Office of Medical Cannabis would be transferred over to this new cannabis management office. As well, the regulation of hemp-derived products. But the recommendation would also include annual funding for ongoing public health functions specifically related to legalizing adult use cannabis, including data collection and monitoring on cannabis use rates, youth cannabis use prevention program, education for pregnant and breastfeeding women about the health effects of cannabis. All of these proposals would provide public health protections for consumer education and safety under a legalized adult use framework. So that was a very, very rapid fire tour, Mr. Chair and members. Happy to take any questions that you have at this point.
Thank you, Commissioner. Members, any questions or comments on the Senator Curran?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Malcolm, this is quite an exhaustive list. I don't know that there are many categories that are left out of that list. How many full-time FTEs does this plan add in current fiscal year and the next fiscal year?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Curran, I will see if any of my colleagues on the line have that total on hand, and if not, we will certainly get it to you.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner, Mr. Chair, this is Margaret Kelly, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Health. We did not summarize those numbers for this presentation, so we will get that over to you.
Thank you.
Yep.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Curran.
Again, Commissioner Malcolm, these interchanges become frustrating, I'm sure, for you as well, but isn't that one of the requirements or one of the basic foundations when you put together a budget proposal? Isn't that staffing needs drive the majority of that? So we would appreciate that information. Thank you.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Curran, absolutely. Each of the budget proposals does have that information. We just simply didn't include it in this slide.
Mr. Chair and Senator Curran, I did get a shout out, a phone a friend shout out. It's 188, roughly 188. FTEs in these proposals combined.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank Grant. You.
Okay. Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, thank you for the good report. I just have a couple questions. I'm sure the documents are there somewhere. I'm just curious on the spending side of things, how much is being called for a new spending in the proposals that you just shared with us? And also I noticed on some of the slides, sometimes it was noted where the money was coming from, if it was coming from some sort of federal funds or if we were expecting that we were taking this out of the general fund or the reserve fund. And so I'd really like to see a breakdown of the total spending, how much is paid for by one-time federal funds, how much is paid for out of our reserve, how much is paid for out of our surplus. I think that's important. And then the follow-up question will be, when that information is available, how much ongoing spending is being paid for with one-time funding? So a bit of a discussion going forward, but I think that's something that we need to know, and I'd appreciate if you could get that information to me.
Okay. Senator Nelson, I'll just jump in here real quick, and we'll let the commissioner follow up too. But in our packets here at the, in our hearing room, it did have the breakdown from general fund, the healthcare access, the dedicated accounts, and the state government special revenue. Commissioner, would that be accurate? That's what you'd refer to also, because that was page 2 of the slide presentation.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And Senator Nelson, I also hear you asking for some distinction between one-time funding and ongoing funding. So we can certainly, add that clarity. But the big picture sources of spending are, as the chair said, on the second page of the slide deck.
Mr. Chair.
Yep, Senator Nelson.
Thank you so much for the clarification, and Commissioner, I thought it might be there. I got in late from some other meetings and would have missed that, and I'll make sure that my staff gets me those documents. So I can view those. And Commissioner, thanks for following up. It's always just good to know how much one-time funding are we using for ongoing expenses. That's something we should all make sure we're well aware of. So thank you so much. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members, any other questions, comments? I'm not seeing any. So anything additional you'd like to add, Commissioner Malcolm, or with that, shall we wrap it up?
And just thank you for your time, Mr. Chair and members. I know we will have many, many conversations about the specifics here, but really appreciate the chance to kind of go over the whole the whole picture with you at a high level. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you again to you and your staff for joining us at this kind of a late hour in the afternoon for us, but I'm glad we got it in. So with that, again, well, thank you. And members, we will stand adjourned until Wednesday, where we have got a full agenda lined up again. So we are adjourned.